Let's get on to Ken's patient. Ken?
Sure. This is a 68-year-old female, non-smoker newspaper reporter, so it's a rarity, diagnosed with modified differentiated adenocarcinoma of the transverse colon on July 7th, 2005. She was operated a week later and was found to have a stage 2A T3 N0 M0 tumor. Her CEA pre-op was 12.7. Her post-op CEA was 0. No adjuvant chemotherapy was given for a social reason. Her husband is essentially chair-bound because of severe COPD, and she did not want to have any sort of toxicity following her surgery because she was the sole caregiver for her husband. Her yearly colonoscopies were negative. On January 8th of this year, she presented to our emergency room with severe right-sided and flank abdominal pain, a temperature of 102.6, and jaundice. She was admitted after an ultrasound showed impacted gallstones. There was a potential mass on ultrasound in the right lobe of the liver. An ERCP had a successful papillotomy. Jaundice, fever, and pain immediately resolved within 24 hours. On February 14th, following antibiotics and as an outpatient, a CAT scan of the abdomen showed a right lobe of liver mass measuring 3.4 centimeters. A percutaneous biopsy was compatible with colon cancer, consistent with her initial primary. I should mention, because I know it's going to be asked, is I do not know how many lymph nodes were examined in the initial pathology. The pathology report said that all lymph nodes examined showed no evidence of metastatic disease. The pathologist did not have any other further information when I went back to talk to him prior to this conference. A second opinion was held who concurred with my opinion that she was potentially resectable. Suggestion was FOLFOX using a modified FOLFOX protocol, 6 cycles, Avastin for 4, followed by resection. Her CEA at the time of diagnosis was 3.7. Her pre-op CEA was 0.2. Treatment was begun on March 4th. Avastin was completed on April 23rd. Chemotherapy was completed on May 21st. Her surgery was done on June 26th. 2 lesions were found next to each other, separated by a rim of quote-unquote normal tissue grossly, one measuring 1.1, one measuring 1.2, and was resected. The patient was discharged on July 3rd. She's taking a cruise, and the question is now, what follow-up chemotherapy should be given? She is willing to accept treatment at this time.
Now, in giving her the preoperative therapy, what were you thinking?
The feeling was is to make this as easy a resection as possible, although she was probably resectable at the time. The question was, given her concern about making it as easy as possible, getting back on her feet as fast as possible, the surgeon thought that he could do a simple segmentectomy if we got it smaller because it was right by the border of 2 segments in her liver.
So, Dan, can you comment on the controversy about neoadjuvant systemic therapy and resectable hepatic disease?
Sure. Did she have a PET scan?
She did not.
I don't PET a lot of people, but this is a PETable case because you need to know where the lesions are before you start chemotherapy. We need to know. Because one of the issues and one of the downsides of neoadjuvant therapy in resectable patients is that what can happen is you may actually get very good responses, so good responses in lesions you didn't see necessarily on CT scan that the surgeon may not be able to operate on them. And one of the major teaching points here is that in patients who have been operated on after neoadjuvant therapy, lesions that are clinically in a complete response by PET and CT have about a 95% chance of still having viable tumor. So we're not curing macroscopic disease with chemotherapy alone. So one downside is the most sensitive thing to do is in the operating room an intraoperative ultrasound. But if the patient has been treated and may have 2 other lesions in the other lobe of the liver that could be RFA'd or resected, you may not know that until 2 years later. So there are pros and cons. So I'm starting to lean more, even in spite of the Nordlinger trial where everybody got pre and post, to say in a clearly resectable patient, I'd certainly CT or MRI, whichever your radiologists do best, and definitely PET. This is a reimbursable PET situation. PET them to make sure they don't have extra hepatic disease and to find other lesions because they do disappear, and then the surgeon just has a harder time finding them. So 2 things, you gave the right number of cycles, more than 6, and your surgeon will yell at you because there'll be hepatotoxicity with any drug, even 5-FU alone, dropped out the Avastin, the bevacizumab, before the surgery. two lesions or zero resection is the most important prognostic issue here. Do you need more chemotherapy is the last question. Obviously, if you followed the Nord-Léger trial, actually 36% of people voted not to do it. They stayed on the cruise because they got no post-operative FOLFOX. So you always have to look at the intent to treat versus what actually happened. And about 50% of people actually did receive more FOLFOX. So I would say, is six cycles of therapy enough? There are now two adjuvant trials in stage 3 colon cancer ongoing in Europe comparing 3 versus 6 months of FOLFOX to see whether or not we can get the same benefit from a shorter treatment with less neurotoxicity. So I would say that probably I would offer this woman three options, obviously. Stay on the cruise, go around the world, and come home. Because I think she has a pretty good cure rate. Probably she had a reasonable disease-free interval. She had stage 2 disease, we think. We don't know the number of negative nodes. We think she had stage 2 disease, which typically has a better outcome than people who have multiple positive nodal disease.
So you're talking about once they recur?
Even when they recur. So they have a better outcome. So she only had two lesions, an R0 resection, 3 years, stage 2 disease. She has at least a 50% cure rate. I'm not sure, as in stage 2 disease, how much more you're going to buy her with more oxaliplatin. If she wanted to do something and not necessarily develop, does she have any neurotoxicity now?
None.
This is one of those long discussions you have with patients of no further treatment, fluoropyrimidine alone for another 6 cycles, or FOLFOX, as in the Nord-Léger trial, recognizing that less than half of the patients actually completed that.
Yeah, that study was interesting because the paper itself, when it got published in that bad UK journal that we don't want to talk about, as well as the editorial with it, I mean, I read it as kind of saying, in general, we think we should use neoadjuvant therapy, and yet really that trial didn't really test that question.
Yeah, you'll see that we're actually publishing in the JCO a combined pooled analysis of two post-operative adjuvant 5-FU leucovorin versus no treatment after liver resection studies that show pretty darn good results. Again, pooling is not the same as a randomized controlled trial. Each trial didn't come to completion. But Nick Petrelli wrote the editorial on this, and he's a fairly firm believer in not giving chemotherapy up front for neoadjuvant. Bernard Nord-Léger, who is the chair of the RTC trial, is. I suspect we're going to get a lot of letters to the editor on this one. I don't think there has to be only one right answer, but I'm leaning more in patients because of issues of hepatotoxicity. And also, if you look at the Nord-Léger trial, the postoperative complication rate was twice as high in the people who got preoperative chemotherapy related to wound healing and hepatic dysfunction. So you may actually, in fact, cause more people to have more problems rather than less. So I'm leaning more toward, in the clearly resectable patient, to just go in there, resect them, and then give post-operative treatment. I think that's the right answer.
So then what do you do if you choose the first-line therapy and the patient did not have a response to the first-line therapy? Do you take them to surgery, although they have resectable disease, or you say, let me give them something to test what kind of chemo? Because the reason for neoadjuvant is also to test what's the response rate before you do surgery. Because if you do surgery, you don't know what they are going to respond to.
It's a good point. As in most instances, very good responses typically predict for good outcomes. Whether it was because of the treatment or you've just selected a good patient population is unclear. Stability is fine. The only thing that's probably not a good thing is progression. Renee Adam in Paris operates on hundreds of patients. And typically, if a patient blows through their chemotherapy, he may not even take them to the operating room because they are almost never cured with resection. In the Nord-Léger trial, actually only 10 people progressed on treatment, and he did not subset out how they did after their resection. And I think there's about 48 months follow-up, so I have to ask him what happened to them. And I just wanted to get one point in, is that I know Dr. Nord-Léger pretty well, and I asked him, I know the study said that the patients who had surgery alone got no chemotherapy, period, end of discussion. But in the countries in which that study was done, there are a lot of people who firmly believe in adjuvant therapy with liver resection. I said, how many people got post-operative treatment that you don't know about? And the answer is they don't really have a way of collecting the data. In the paper, there's only one sentence in there that says that nobody received post-operative adjuvant chemotherapy. And I have to say, I don't believe it. I just honestly don't believe it. Because once they had the resection at some hospital and went home, If you don't have a mechanism for collecting data, how do you know that? The devil is going to be in that detail. Because what that might have done, obviously, is make the difference much less than it actually turned out to be. The primary endpoint of that study was not met in the intent to treat analysis. It was only when you looked at the resected patients where you saw a significant difference in disease-free survivorship. It doesn't make me disbelieve that adjuvant therapy works or that it shouldn't be used. But obviously, if some of the people in the surgery alone arm got post-operative anything, FOLFIRI, FOLFOX, whatever, then that would have narrowed the difference between, because I don't think the timing makes the difference. I think it's the treatment.
How often do you see patients, let's say a year, where you're thinking about hepatic resection in this situation? Is it a rare situation? Do you see a few a year, low, how often?
I think it's fairly rare, at least in private practice.
Like what, one a year, less?
Yeah, I'd say something like that.
And generally, who's doing the surgery? Is it you send them to referral places, or do you usually have your local surgeon?
I usually send them.
Yeah, I'm pretty much sending those patients to Moffitt, and I don't really have any, my general surgeons are fine with it.
How do you think an oncologist in practice, Dan, should evaluate their surgeon in terms of, you mentioned rectal cancer, and also in terms of hepatic resection? Does it get back to volume?
It absolutely goes to volume. I think that there's enormous amount of good intuition on the part of the surgeons who operate as to what they can do and what they can't do. And we actually present every case that appears at least even marginally resectable to our liver surgeons for their opinion. And there are times where they say no, and I still think yes, and I'll send them either up to Memorial or down to MD Anderson or somewhere else for a final answer, because colon cancer is, even though it's not a common sort of thing to see, colon cancer is still, I think, one of the rare solid tumors that can be cured in a small percentage of patients, but the absolute number is actually quite high. So I think if you don't think of the question, you'll never get an answer to it. So liver resection, to me, is your one shot at potentially curing a patient with metastatic disease, and sequencing of how you do it starts on day one. So that's why these patients all get reviewed, and I have a lot of names around the country of friends of mine who do the liver surgery, and they're more than happy if I send just the images of the patient. They don't need to have someone fly to another city. They just need to have a CD of the images sent, and if they say, I think I can do it, if you can downstage this patient and allow them to be operable, then we have a package.
Ken?
Yeah, I've been impressed when you're asking about percentage about how much more I'm thinking about this because of embolization. We have two new, one's my generation, but one who's always been very aggressive in dealing with embolizing the tumor and allowing hypertrophy of the liver, and that seems to be something that is getting more and more play in the literature.
Now, is that more in primary liver cancer or is also metastatic?
Metastatic disease where they are...
Well, the principle here is not to attack the tumor.
Tumor, right.
The principle is if you have a very large tumor where you're going to have less than 30% of the liver volume left as you embolize and allow the opposite lobe to hypertrophy, and then you do it in a staged procedure. So there are also staged procedures. And sitting here in front of me, which you obviously can't see on the DVD, is a paper we're going to publish from René Adam in Paris, who I think must operate 24 hours a day, reporting on the subset of patients who have portal node involvement, and some of them are curable. The editorial will say, yes, this is a very small percentage, obviously, in this big practice. But portal nodes do not preclude curability in subsets of patients.
But I just want to clarify. So you're saying it's common to use embolization in metastatic disease?
It's for patients who have large lesions where the surgeon says, if I take this out, the patient's going to have less than 30% of functional liver left.
Yeah, I just sent someone to Moffitt in this very difficult type case. That's the first thing Timothy Aitman's going to do is going to embolize the liver first.
Right. And essentially what you're doing is giving the patient an extra 20 or 30% of liver so that when they have the resection, they don't die from hepatic failure because you left them with 25% of the liver left. It's a staged technique. And again, you're now subsetting down to about 2 or 3% of the total population of people with metastatic disease. That's why...
But the issue that came up, and I think it's very important, and this was a learning experience for me, so old dogs can learn new tricks, is that the surgeons that we sent them to an academic center that did, and I think most general oncologists will do that because they are the ones who have the house staff and the blood supply and coagulation specialists and the whole shebang, is that they're making the right extended lobe resections. You have a gigantic tumor in your liver, or one, two, and you're going to have to take everything out. They say now that is now surgically acceptable. I mean, it's like the new maps of what the liver and the segments are, things that 25 years ago or 20 years ago were considered unresectable. And the basic premise is what Neil and Dr. Ellis brought out, is that these are now potentially curable patients. It's not a palliative event. So one of the things is, and PET scanning is an interesting point, is how aggressive we are in looking for metastatic disease elsewhere. Because it's almost like doing a pancreatectomy. If you find anything outside the liver, they will stop. So they oftentimes will look underneath diaphragms, they'll flip up. I've actually watched one of the operations, and it's not just going in and coagulating. They actually are doing a search and destroy mission, looking for any sort of reasons not to do the surgery.
I think that's a perfectly appropriate comment.
Neil, Aaron, the other cases that are coming up, are we going to be discussing any of the non-surgical approaches to the local control in the liver, so the radiofrequency ablation, stereotactic radiation? These things always come up, even microspheres and all of that. We're hearing more and more, and our radiation oncologists are very into stereotactic radiation of unresectable areas in the liver.
Bill just presented a case of a patient who had major complication from that, too.
Right.
It was a lady. What happened with
that
woman?
A breast cancer lady. She's doing a little better right now.
She had surgery. You can maybe just briefly say what happened there.
Well, she had stereotactic radiation for liver metastases from breast cancer, and she developed a necrotic area in her duodenum, which caused tremendous amounts of pain, and they ended up having to bypass her.
Any comment about this issue of non-surgical approaches to metastatic disease?
The most difficult part of this, I think surgery is always the gold standard, frankly, because R0 resections, meaning total destruction of a lesion, is very important. One of the issues with procedures like radiofrequency ablation or Surspheres or any of the other things is that they go through a totally different approval process than chemotherapeutics, where you have to prove efficacy. All you have to prove for these agents is that you can do it. So the likelihood that you're ever going to get any kind of randomized trial between a resection versus these other non-potentially curative procedures is zero. I think there are certain issues where we do it. We more often do chemoembolization because we have a very good program, and obviously you can do it even in large tumors, is if people have non-curative but large metastatic disease in the liver that can be chemoembolized, you might actually help their quality of life and even perhaps their length of life by reducing the likelihood that they're going to die from liver-only disease. And so we use that procedure in a very limited number of patients. And RFA can be used, certainly, and many surgeons will do it in the operating room, as you presented in your case, Mike, where, let's say, you have to take a large part of the right lobe of the liver out for a big lesion, but on intraoperative ultrasound, you see like a 1 centimeter lesion in the left lobe. Most docs, if it were in a tough position, would probably just do RFA in the operating room, but be very aware that it's more likely than not that the tumor will probably regrow in that area and then need a second procedure, which has also been reported to be successful.
You think about people going through this kind of surgery, major morbidity, and then developing progressive disease like your case, Mike, before, and hopefully there are going to be trials looking at these patients in the U.S. I don't think there's ever been one completed. There's a lot of talk about looking at genomic predictors in the adjuvant setting. Well, there's a lot of new exciting stuff going on there, but maybe, hopefully, we could look at the tissue in the liver and maybe figure out who are the patients who we can cure and need surgery and who it's going to be futile in. Do you think that's coming down the line, Dan?
Absolutely. But, you know, right now we have a lot of good predictors already. Numbers of lesions, as in real estate, location of the lesions, as in this patient, stage at presentation, R0 versus not resection. So we already have tons of predictors. It may be true that we'll learn something biologically, but in a multivariable analysis, it could turn out that some of our simple clinical pathologic things may trump a biologic imperator.